I'm Christopher Light, and this is The Connection. It was pure Yeltsin, everybody is saying. Boris Yeltsin's surprise resignation on New Year's Eve was the kind of grand political gesture that's become his signature. It was precisely timed to dazzle and to surprise, and also to ensure Yeltsin's legacy and his hand-picked successor, Vladimir Putin. Yeltsin will be remembered as the man who replaced Mikhail Gorbachev's communism with a human face, with a fledgling democracy and market capitalism, with free elections and a lively press. But it had Boris Yeltsin's own mark of human imperfectibility, too. Drunkenness, boredom, sloth, corruption, and bureaucracy. In his resignation speech, Yeltsin said, "I ask your forgiveness for the fact that many of the dreams we shared did not come true, and for not justifying some hopes of those people who believed that at one stroke, in one spurt, we could leap from the gray, stagnant, totalitarian past into the light, rich, civilized future." Still, if you ask most Russians if they're better off today than they were 8 years ago, many would doubtless say yes. And that's the stuff that politics and presidential campaigns are made of. We're talking about Boris Yeltsin's legacy and Vladimir Putin's future this hour on The Connection. Our guests are two reporters who led the Wall Street Journal's Pulitzer Prize Moscow team through the Yeltsin years. Steve Leisman is in a studio in New York. Andrew Higgins joins us by phone from Moscow. Connection listeners, how will history, how will you remember Boris Yeltsin? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK to make the Boris Yeltsin connection. Andrew Higgins is the Moscow bureau chief of the Wall Street Journal. Starting with you, thank you for being with us, Andrew Higgins. I want to know how we get away with it, but also, just for starters, what does it mean that Putin has already sacked Yeltsin's daughter and with a whiff of anti-corruption ism about it?
Well, it's not so much a whiff as a very faint hint. But I don't think he had much choice. This was Yeltsin's daughter, and she had no other qualifications for having a job in the Kremlin other than the fact that she was the daughter of the president, and Mr. Yeltsin's no longer the president, and she's the daughter, so I think she goes with her dad, and that's about it. The inner core of his sort of circle is still very much in the Kremlin, or at least circling around the edges, and the real test will come whether he can actually take some moves against the people who are far more powerful than Tatiana.
You, the two of you wrote a marvelous sort of summing up of Boris Yeltsin, which you said it was like being at a tennis game too long, to the point that your neck hurt watching the contortions of Boris Yeltsin. I mean, give us some of the high and the low lights.
Well, for me, certainly one of the low points was sitting in Grozny during the first Chechen War 5 years ago now. And it's absolutely surreal to come back and find that they're fighting another war down there. But I remember sitting in a ramshackle hotel listening in onto the BBC and hearing Yeltsin announce that there were no military activities going on whatsoever in Chechnya, and he'd called peace and everything was in order, and then a bomb exploding about 100 yards down the road. The next day, listened again, no more military activities, and the following morning we went out and saw that Russian aircraft had bombed an orphanage. And this seemed to be very significant of the very, very, the nadir of Yeltsin's rule, when he just seemed to be completely out of touch with reality.
How did he get away with it? I mean, it's an odd question to ask from the land of Bill Clinton, but I mean, what sustained him?
Well, what sustained him, aside from Chechnya, he has a pretty remarkable record, and certainly his personal ambition intersected at many points in a very clumsy way with historic destiny. And he has left a sort of ramshackle but remarkably functioning democracy, and he has demolished central planning, and that is an achievement which, you know, you can't take away from him.
Steve Leisman, do you agree with that generous sort of obituary?
Just to be clear, it's a little bit early for an obituary, a political obituary for sure. But, in general, I do. I think that the general impression of Yeltsin in the West was probably worse than the reality of him. I think you need to take a whole mix of all of his accomplishments and failures and put them together. And on balance, I think you come up positive. In large part because there is the potential now for things to get better, and a lot depends upon how Putin is going to interpret the Yeltsin legacy. He has a variety of tools at his disposal that weren't there beforehand. There's a functioning central bank. There's control over the monetary policy. There is a monetary policy. There wasn't monetary anything in the Soviet era. As you said at the beginning, there have been a series of national elections. That's a tool. That's the nascent beginnings of a democratic institution. You didn't have that before. You had single candidates, and you didn't have real competition. That exists. Again, it depends on how Putin interprets it. He can decide to run ramshackle over the process, but yet win again in an election, or he can open it up. And I don't think the early indications on that are actually very promising. But yeah, in general, I agree with the positive assessment, because it's one that is a theory that most explains where we're at right now.
Well, you know, it's always a matter of perspective and emphasis, I suppose. But both in the economy and in democracy, you know, in the political democracy, it seems to me there are just monumental contradictions. It was revealed sort of after his last election that he seemed to be owned and operated by the Magnificent Seven, by the oligarchy, as was called, or had given away huge public resources to a handful of people that seemed to own him. His own election in the aftermath looked like a kind of world conspiracy, including by the Americans, to just kind of keep the communists down. And this last election, I mean, it seemed to be almost a parody of the very worst kind of American oligarchy, manipulation, dirty tricks, attack politics. Is that what we simply must learn to celebrate as a fashion, as the Yeltsin bargain?
I've always sort of wondered what the standard should be, and there's two ways of looking at this country, and I don't think either is wrong. But the first is, well, what should one rightly expect of a country that had such a major overhaul in 1991? And the second is, what are there universal standards that one has about democracy? On the second judgment, Russia's doesn't add up, and it looks really bad, and to our sensibilities, all those things are correct. But if you take it from the first, that maybe one shouldn't expect at the very beginning to have a pure democracy. I mean, if you look at it, America, in many ways, we have something that there are analogies for what's going on in Russia right now in America. And then decide that this is not something that is going to be a done deal in a decade, but maybe look at it as a generational change and say, okay, we got this piece now. Let's go on to the next piece. That is, to me, a better way to look at it. And not go to Russia and say, well, how are you in my Western judgment relative to what I have after however many hundreds of years in Western Europe or in the United States?
I think it's a fair point. Andrew Higgins, I'd put it to you, though. The real question, I suppose, is not how pure is the democracy. It'll never be pure, and ours surely isn't. But is Russia a place today where you would want to invest your own money if you were a Russian, much less a Paris banker or an American? And is it a place where you would have some fair hope that your 22-year-old son or daughter might find a future? Or would you be looking to emigrate and get your bucks out?
Well, if you'd put your money in the Russian stock exchange at the beginning of the year, you would have done far, far better than you'd have done on any NASDAQ stock.
Wow, that's pretty well.
It's gone up, I think, 300% something since the beginning of the year, which is a pretty remarkable achievement. But, of course, I mean, the problem here is that the Russian, well, any stock exchange really often doesn't have much to do with the real economy. And the real economy is a wreck by our standards. But even there, despite the crash in 98, after which everyone was screaming that Russia was doomed forever, hyperinflation is just around the corner, or bread riots, people were going to start blowing up banks because they couldn't get their money out. And none of that happened. In fact, the Russian economy now is perhaps better or healthier, and still pretty sickly, than it has been for a decade. So here again we have this contradiction that everything seemed awful, and something happened, and it's far better than any of us expected. Though, of course, again, from a very, very, very low base. Poverty is extraordinary, something like 30% below the poverty line, according to official statistics, which is pretty desperate. But then, on the other hand, no, things are improving somewhat.
What do you measure by immigration, emigration, or talk of immigration?
I don't. I mean, that's not something I hear so particularly frequently when you talk to Russians. I mean, I spent many, many years in China, and I know there that virtually everyone I knew was trying to wangle a visa to get to the States, or basically to get to anywhere, get to Congo, just to get out. And that's probably changed in recent years in China, but I never confronted that in Russia, this sort of mad stampede to get out of the country. And I think people here do have the sense that there is this hope that things could get better. They haven't got better for most, but there is a chance that they could.
Mikhail Gorbachev sort of sank without a trace almost as soon as he left office as the man who gave away the Soviet system and the Soviet Empire. What do you suppose a year from now people will be saying about Boris Nikolaevich?
Well, I think Boris Nikolaevich will sink probably even faster from view than Mikhail Gorbachev. For one thing, he's a far, far sicker man than Mr. Gorbachev is. 10 years on, Gorbachev is still in pretty good shape and travels around the world giving speeches and collecting money for those, and is a sprightly figure and has things to say. I think Yeltsin is a very, very different, a very different case. He's an extremely ill, infirm, feeble, and I think we won't really see much of him anymore, though he's just declared, I think yesterday the Kremlin set up a special office to handle his future trips and his appearances, and he's declared that he will travel around the country. But I doubt very much he'll do that. I mean, in his last few foreign trips have been a fiasco. He's sort of stumbled and mumbled, and when he was in China recently, he was announcing, well, giving what amounted to a threat of nuclear war. A sort of off-the-cuff remark, which can be looked at in a sort of humorous light if you want, but it's also a bit worrying. I think he'll be probably retired to his dacha.
Will people remember him as the father of this kind of limping, but kind of, I don't know, unsinkable democracy at the same time, too? I mean, do people honor him with a kind of founding father sort of mentality?
I think they do, more than in a way Gorbachev. I mean, Gorbachev's problem was that when he talks, he blabs on and on and on, that most people just sort of turn off, and he's seen very much as a sort of product of the old system where speeches lasted for hours and nothing was ever really done, and people would sit around and talk and talk and talk, whereas Yeltsin inspires real passions, often very negative passions, but also very positive passions. And I think people, they're very ambivalent, but he's certainly a figure that they will honor, despise, all at once.
Yeltsin had a, this is Steve Leisman talking, had a folksy quality that did capture the imagination of some people. We, you know, had some older pensioner friends who labeled him Nash Borka, and Borka would be a diminutive form of Boris. Whatever they felt about him, he was certainly captured their imagination. And the evening that Yeltsin resigned, I called them up from New York, and they quickly had a joke about him, calling him Nash Novy Pensy, which is our new pensioner, our newest pensioner.
1-800-423-8255 makes the farewell to Boris Yeltsin connection. 1-800-423-TALK with the Pulitzer Prize team of the Wall Street Journal covering Boris Yeltsin and his years in Moscow. Steve Leisman, who joins us from New York, and Andrew Higgins, the chief of the Moscow Bureau. 1-800-423-8255. You know, we've been prepared for a long time. I think it was Richard Lurie who first pointed out to me that the succession in Russia is always from a bald guy to a hairy guy, starting in the modern times with Lenin and Stalin. Vladimir Putin is about bald enough, I guess, to succeed the hairy Boris Yeltsin. Is the Yeltsin stamp going to persist in the Putin regime?
This is Andy in Moscow. Well, I think in style, no, not at all. We're going to see a very, very different manner in the Kremlin. For the first time, well, since Gorbachev left office, we're going to see an engaged leader. I mean, this has possible negative connotations as well. Here is a man, as we've seen in Chechnya, who will take the bull by the horn and shake it pretty brutally if necessary. Unlike Yeltsin, who I think in Chechnya, when he waged his own war down there, the problems were not that he had mandated a sort of savage war. It was that he just wasn't really, he didn't bother. Yeltsin went to Chechnya once throughout the first war, flew into the airport, declared victory, flew out, and a few weeks later, Russian troops retreated in utter disarray. Whereas Putin is a man who has been there three times just in recent months. He will take issues and try and solve them in a far more concentrated, vigorous way.
What does Chris, go ahead, Steve.
Sorry, I'd be interested in Andy's feelings about this, but from one respect, Yeltsin's infirmities allowed the Russian governmental system to work the way it's set up, in that there is a government that's supposed to be underneath the president. The president appoints a prime minister who then appoints a cabinet in consultation with the president. The fact that Yeltsin was so infirm most of the time and on the sidelines and really working behind the scenes in the shadows essentially allowed the government system to work. But what's unclear to me is the extent to which you can have an active president with a government underneath him. I'm not quite sure where the balance of that power is going to work out with a guy who's not in the hospital all the time. Andy?
Well, yeah, Yeltsin's feebleness was certainly a sort of an ad hoc form of checks and balances, but it's certainly not the ideal solution. And I think most of the serious problems we have now, namely corruption and drift, can be attributed to Yeltsin's, basically his decrepit state. I mean, he just was not engaged in government. He was a sort of semi-detached or even entirely detached leader for a lot of this time. And I think, you know, in the broad lines, he took the right decisions. But the problem was between these, taking these right decisions, he just drifted off. And basically, everyone did what they wanted, including the government, including ministers. I mean, I've been in meetings with ministers when they start scrawling notes, attacking the president, saying he's corrupt and et cetera, which is extraordinary. This was a place where there was, in the government apparatus, all sort of sense of discipline began to break down.
Can I ask you both to talk a little bit more about Vladimir Putin on a couple of points? He's a former KGB guy, a sort of creature of the old school. At the same time, I mean, you'd suppose we keep looking for a new generation of Russian politicians and leaders and professionals, government managers. Who is he and who's around him? Is it a new generation?
It's new in that it's young, or younger. Putin is 47, which is 21 years younger than Yeltsin. Whether they're entirely new in their outlook, I really don't know. Putin is very much of an enigma. He comes certainly from the KGB, but then George Bush. I mean, he was the head of the CIA. Does that make him, a sort of sinister character? Though, of course,
not sinister, but it marks him as a sort of a man of the eternal government.
Sorry?
I mean, it marks him as a man of the kind of permanent establishment.
No, I think definitely. Putin is very much a creature of the apparatus, the government. He's never held an elected office. He has sort of rubbed shoulders in Petersburg in the early 90s with the people we call the reformers, Chubais, Sobchak, and others. So maybe he's picked something up, but he's very much part of the status quo communist when it existed, and the reformist status quo now. He's not a man who's really had any time outside of government.
Doesn't everything hang in a certain way on his prevailing in Chechnya, but in certainly getting out of there in some style? Doesn't seem to be guaranteed.
No, far from it. I mean, I think that's one reason why Yeltsin resigned when he did, to bring elections forward from June to March, because this war is not going to end anytime soon. They may drive the rebels out of Grozny. They may, take most of the lowlands, but there's going to be a long and sustained guerrilla campaign. And I think if the election's been held in June, there was a good chance that Russian casualties would mount, and the sort of some of the luster would begin to wear off a bit. I mean, we have to remember that in the earlier war, the Russians had won. They had seized Grozny, they'd raised Russian flags across the region. And then almost overnight, their authority crumbled. They found they were surrounded by Chechen rebels, and they pulled out. I mean, it was an extraordinary scene where this former superpower just turned tail and ran away. And a humiliating defeat of sort of staggering proportions. And I think, that's one thing we have to remember, that the earlier experience could possibly repeat itself. So Mr. Putin is engaged. He is taking an interest in what the army is doing down there. So maybe it will be different in terms of the tactics, and that the prosecution of the war, but I'm not sure whether the basic conditions of the war, i.e. people who really don't want to live in Russia, and we'll keep fighting.
Connection listeners, we're measuring the late, I shouldn't say late, Boris Yeltsin, the former president of the new Russia, who resigned on New Year's Eve, with the Pulitzer Prize team of the Wall Street Journal, Steve Leisman, who joins us from New York, Andrew Higgins, the Moscow bureau chief. The phone is 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. Ahmed is on the line. Good morning, Ahmed.
Good morning. My comment is coming from a very simple individual who observed the events as it unfolded. When the coup became evident, and Mr. Gorbachev and his wife, in that stressful condition, brought back from Crimea when they were on their vacation, Mr. Yeltsin came to the scene and started fighting the coup, which was fine, and one would expect that he would certainly back Mr. Gorbachev, who was the victim at the time. But as I remember from newsreel and on TV, he was turning the events against Gorbachev at the same time over his own differences with him. And one scene in particular, when he was wagging his finger in front of Mr. Gorbachev's face in the parliament, was very embarrassing to international media and politicians. Mr. Bob Dole in our Senate said, we have to do something with this 80-pound gorilla before he starts doing terrible things. So that was basically Mr. Yeltsin's personality, and it was known. Mr. Yeltsin was not a principled man, and it was evident. And throughout his rule, he also violated so many principles. Let's say bringing the tanks and bombarding the parliament.
I think we'll grant you the point that he was in every way contradictory.
Well, yes, but again. Very, very faithful audience and observant in these things. I don't get that feeling.
I don't either. I put it to our Wall Street Journal guys. I mean, where were his keepers? Where were the oligarchs, the Magnificent Seven, in the last year or two, and in his resignation?
Well, I mean, first of all, back to the issue of 1991. I think. The incident in the Supreme Soviet when Yeltsin was wagging his finger at Gorbachev, that sort of sums up Yeltsin in many ways, both his good and his bad. He was a man who, yes, on one level was driven by his personal ambition. But I think at the same time you have to acknowledge that what flowed from that personal ambition was a sort of, I mean, to use a corny phrase, there's a rendezvous with destiny. And the Soviet Union fell apart, and without Yeltsin driving it, I think we might be still staggering along in with ramshackle empire, and maybe with Chechnyas all across the borders.
Remember that Gorbachev was trying to reform the communist system, and that was leading nowhere over a six-year period. And picking up on the theme of rendezvous with destiny, that the communist system had to be scrapped, and Gorbachev had to be scrapped along with it. There was no way for Gorbachev to lead the Soviet Union out of its morass with the theories that he was propounding.
Steve Leisman, thank you. And Ahmed, thank you. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Boris Yeltsin connection. Catherine's calling from Virginia Beach, Virginia.
Hello, good morning.
Welcome, Catherine.
My question is, I think it's all very intriguing, and I'm following it, as I think we all are. My question is whether or not we know anything about his background.
Who's now? Putin's?
Yes, Putin's background. Being a Virginian and a Southerner, we know, we mothers know, that the early childhood years, the formative years, are rather important in building one's character. And my concern is I'm wondering whether he's a robot or not. Whether he's married. Do you know these?
Well,
Andrew Higgins, give us the thumbnail.
Yes, he's married. He took his wife on a military helicopter to fly over Chechnya for New Year's Eve. Maybe that gives some indication of his personal life. He has two daughters, and one of which, at least, is at a German language school in Moscow. And Putin himself speaks German, which he learned, or certainly practiced to some fluency while he was in Dresden in East Germany, which is where he worked as a lieutenant colonel of the KGB. There are some different stories of what he was actually doing in East Germany. Among his tasks was sort of monitoring Western technology. And you mentioned a robot. He was actually involved in following an East German company there called Robotronics or something like that, which was one of the sort of foremost computer or embryonic computer forms of the Soviet bloc. So maybe he does have robotic tendencies.
Let's hope there is something like Crazy Boris's democratic passion in that robotic heart of Vladimir Putin. Andrew Higgins, I'm sorry to say we have to let you go at the break. We're delighted to have had you on The Connection. Thank you enormously. Andrew Higgins, the Moscow bureau chief for The Wall Street Journal. Steve Leisman, who won the Pulitzer Prize with him, is with us after the break. And Richard Lurie, the autobiographer of Joseph Stalin, will be back. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. We're funded by the listeners of WBUR Boston and by the construction site Blocks and Building Toys for girls and boys aged infant to infinity. Toys with connections that snap, stack, screw, and slide together at constructiontoys.com. And by Magic Hour Communications, helping Fortune 1000 and fast-growing companies sell, market, and educate through videos, multimedia, websites, and presentations. Magic-hour.com. I'm Christopher Light, and this is the Boris Yeltsin Connection. Remembering the first Democratic president of the new Russia who resigned on New Year's Eve, our phone is 1-800-423-8255. How will we, how should we, how do we remember Boris Yeltsin? Steve Leisman, who co-won the Pulitzer Prize for the Wall Street Journal for his coverage of the Yeltsin years, joins us by phone from New York. And also Richard Lurie, the novelist who presumed to write the autobiography of Joseph Stalin, which is part of the context, too, here. Welcome back, Richard Lurie.
Happy New Year, Chris.
Tell us what this transition is all about, from Yeltsin to Putin.
I'll tell you how it looks to me this morning. I mean, everything is very minute by minute, but Putin, who I see as a kind of a Giuliani figure, actually, that's the person he intuitively reminds me of, is Giuliani, the sort of cop become political boss, and I wouldn't be surprised if he behaved in some ways like Giuliani. I think his problem is this. If he wins the war in Chechnya, the rebels will not only, I think, turn to guerrilla warfare, which is obvious, but I think they'll turn to terrorism. And if we remember back to 95, the same person who's heading up the operation for the rebels, Shamil Basayev, notified the Russian press that he had planted radioactive material in Izmailovsky Park, which is a big park in Moscow, and they ran to the park and dug it up, and sure enough, it was there. It was cesium-137 or something like that. Not terribly dangerous, but the point, it was a sort of, in a certain sense, a kind of a mafioso gesture just to say, this is what we can do if we need to do it.
So that had been planted, remind us, by whom?
By Shamil Basayev, the person who's running who is essentially the head of the Chechen rebels.
Okay.
And he called the press, notified them, they went to the park, dug it up, and sure enough, it was there. That incident came back to my mind this morning when I was thinking about how are they going to, what are the rebels going to do if they lose, and what is Putin going to do if he wins the war? He's got to win the aftermath of the war, too, and that could even be more difficult. So Putin's in a tough spot. If he loses the war, it's obviously bad. If he wins the war, it could be just as bad. So to take a dark view, he's almost in a lose-lose situation.
Richard, take us back to the still coming out of the Stalinist context, and talk a little bit about what Russia has been in the Yeltsin years and what it's becoming today.
Well, the thing is, I basically agree with the point of view that, you know, Russia has come a long way in a short time. I mean, this, if you take the hugest view, there's the 1,000 years of Russian history in which there was practically, you know, not a an inkling of freedom or democracy. And suddenly there is something that is a sort of crude cartoon of democracy, but nevertheless democracy. And sometimes even Russians themselves become a little too quickly blasé about it. I mean, freedom of travel was one of the hot issues in the 70s, and now something like 12 million Russians went abroad last year, and most of them came back. So they have come a long way from their 1,000 years of autocratic rule, and you know, it's not so long ago that Stalin and Khrushchev was one of his inner circle, and Brezhnev was a kind of a, what they used to call a sluggish Stalinist. So in that sense, I think they've come a long way. When we talk about how Yeltsin will be remembered, I think it's entirely a function of what happens in the next, say, 5 years, because if Russia continues, even in its kind of sort of lumbering way, to move in the right direction, then his position historically, it'll be mixed, but everything is mixed over there. But he'll be a figure of great importance. But if this turns out to be an episode like NEP, the new economic policy that Lenin introduced in the early 20s to get the Russian economy back on its feet, but didn't last long, then Yeltsin will be reduced to a kind of a tragic comic footnote. So it's not clear whether, you know, one of the assumptions we're all working on these days is the irreversibility of things. And it's true. I don't think Russia will ever go back to what it was. The question is, what's it stumbling towards? You know, what great beast is slouching out there? I mean, it could be heading towards something like disintegration, in which case Yeltsin and Gorbachev will be linked together as people who undid the House of Russia.
I'd ask you, Richard, and also Steve Leisman, can one see in the sort of post-Yeltsin time here a kind of developing center in Russian democratic politics, cartoon democracy or a real? Is there a center being formed here?
I think this
Steve Leisman?
I think a center was formed actually a long time ago. I think it was formed around 96. And again, I think you need to go back to what it was to sort of appreciate the progress of what it became. If you think about the center in the Soviet times, it was a Politburo of a few people who sat around a table and made a lot of the decisions that affected the country and the future. And in around the time of the 96 election, it became quite apparent that there were still a bunch of guys sitting around tables, but it was many more people around the table and many more tables. There were a series of interest groups. Now, we talk about the oligarchs, and this is all well and good, and it's right to criticize the oligarchy, but the oligarchy is a much broader circle of people with business interests, with economic interests, than there were beforehand, and with motivations that are perhaps in some ways much more aligned with what we'd like in the West than there were before, as opposed to an ideological or some kind of personal connection interest that a Politburo member might have had. Now it's the interest of his or her bank or his or oil company or something like that, which is a much better motivation we'd like to see. There's the rise of the church, which is very important. There are military-industrial complexes. There's a parliament that, even though it's weak in power, it has certainly has a say in how things go forward in important legislation. There is a bit of compromise between the executive and the legislature. And ultimately, at the center is a rather unique idea, which is that the only way to happen to hold power in Russia today is to have won it through a democratic election. There are huge problems in the issue of how you get to that election. The laws concerning the campaign financing, concerning the use of the state media, all of that tends to, in Western eyes, make Russia's democracy look laughable. But at the end of the day, the elections have been pretty much clean. There is not a whole lot of issue about rigging of the vote. Yeltsin, he used the state media. He spent enormous sums of money in the 96 election which would have violated most of Russia's own campaign finance laws. But at the end of the day, what put him in power was the vote and what maintained his power.
Interesting. That's rather cheerful. Richard Lurie, do you want to word on that?
I would add one thing to that, which is, as far as the question of the center goes, I mean, what Russia was always missing socially, if not politically, was a center. And the center that I think is forming now in Russia is a middle class whose interests are tend towards stability and continuity and centrist politics. And, you know, to some degree, we have to be careful that we're not projecting our own values onto a country with a different history and nature. But it is true, I think, that now more than ever, there's an emerging middle class in Russia, and its desires and its politics are largely dictated by its interests. And I would expect that there's nobody, I think, even the communists now have rescinded their position on renationalization of industry. I mean, I think there's a definite commitment now to some form of free market capitalism, and that inevitably is producing a middle class. And I think that's the great stable point in all this flux and flow. And I did a kind of sort of informal sample of what I call the cell phone Russians, meaning these young 30-year-old entrepreneur types who are in New York, and I run into them at parties, and they're almost indistinguishable from anybody else. And they're rather pro-Putin, all of these people, because I think just in the simplest way, that I think that they see him as young and vigorous and future oriented like themselves, and not a lumbering beast like Yeltsin. And the other thing, of course, is, and we have to remember, if you look at today's New York Times, where the Russians had a great PR coup because they freed a hostage who had been held since September, the situation in Chechnya was truly a mess, and it was utterly anarchic. Sort of warlords were ruling. The government had no control over the situation. Whether the Chechens were responsible for the bombings in Russia itself, Russia proper, I should say, is unclear. But they definitely invaded Dagestan, and so I think that the popular sentiment for the war and Putin will last for a good while, unless too many people start coming home in body bags.
Richard Lurie and Stephen Leisman stand by. We're talking about Russia after Boris Yeltsin. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Yeltsin connection, or 1-800-423-TALK. Josh is on the line.
Good morning, Chris. It's Josh Rubenstein from Amnesty.
Oh, good morning, Joshua.
Hi, Josh.
Good morning. Hi, Richard.
Yeah.
I'd like to make a point that I find a bit awkward and troubling. On the one hand, in my opinion, I think it's the general consensus, is that Putin's popularity, broadly speaking, in Russia is based on his tough response in Chechnya, his response to the bombings that took place in Moscow, in the winter. But on the other hand, and this is what I find very paradoxical, I've been talking to my friends in Petersburg and in Moscow this past week over the new year.
They have cell phones, too, Joshua?
Yeah, and these are people whom we would consider very democratically oriented and Western-oriented. They want their country to progress. They're obviously anti-communists. And their feeling is that Putin is the best of the lot, that he offers an alternative to Yeltsin, obviously, an alternative to the communists, to the more right-wing nationalists. And he's acceptable to the nationalist bloc, but he's not as extreme as, say, the communists and obviously Zhirinovsky and others. So they see him as an acceptable alternative. But what is troubling is here are people whom you and I would identify with as democratically oriented, and they accept him at the same time that the general population sees him, not for his democratic credentials, which he has none, but because of his tough response in Chechnya. And so how the situation in Chechnya unfolds over the next few months is really going to be key to his popularity, but it may not be key to Russia's making progress in terms of becoming more of a Western-style democracy.
Steve Leisman.
Yeah, just very quickly, one thing that you did find in the years that I was in Moscow, which was 92 to 98, is the reformers, the Western style people, the Western style progressive people that I think Josh is talking about, they lost their illusions along the way, as did perhaps Mr. Yeltsin. There was very little left of the promise of 92 by the time you got around to 95 and 96. And I think a certain realpolitik has taken over these people. And the other interesting development, I think, is the rise of nationalism at the center of Russian politics. And if you look at it, Russia did swing dramatically towards the West in the early part of the 90s, where everything the West did was good. And anything that was Russian was bad. And I think what you have now is a correction underway, which is a return to, well, Russia is good. Russian products, although Western products still beat out Russian products, a sense of we should buy some Russian products, a sense of maybe there is something left of Russian pride. And that now is at the center of Russian politics, such that Putin can, he must talk like a nationalist, whereas before that was sort of far-right type of rhetoric.
Well, there's talking like a nationalist in a way to assuage people's feelings after all the country's gone through a great trauma.
Right.
There's nothing wrong with building up its own productive capacities in contrast to the West, and you know, more favoring, you know, domestic industries. That would be great for Russia. But there is a question about what his what his intentions are from a democratic point of view. Hmm. We've all talked to Yevgenia Albats recently, who raised the I think she hit the nail on the head. What are his concerns when it comes to human rights? Will there be a severe step backward? Or will it simply be tough talk with regard to Chechnya, but no real compromise of freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of people to assemble, which has been the accomplishment, the substantial accomplishment of the last 10 years?
Well, yeah, he's in a sort of a Lyndon Johnson-ish sort of bind, isn't he? I mean, one part of his political base, it depends on this, on prevailing in a very ugly way, in a kind of disreputable war. And the other part is sort of sustaining a kind of reform program. I mean, in Lyndon Johnson's case, it was civil rights and the Great Society. But these are two very different political bases, and there's not so much a collision, there's a split just built into it, isn't there?
Well, that's the paradox I was pointing to. And for now, I think these two sides will hold because neither has much of an alternative. But if things go sour in Chechnya, or as Richard pointed out, rightfully so, if the Russians are perceived as winning in Chechnya, but then the Chechens or their allies engage in violence in Russian cities, either near Chechnya or even in Moscow or Petersburg itself, obviously there has to be a political solution down the road that both sides can live with. Otherwise, there will be ongoing violence.
Chris, let me just interject one other thing here.
Steve Leisman.
The West yet hasn't had its say or its sway on Mr. Putin. One thing that's always been true in Russian politics is that you don't want to be seen pandering to the West, but you do have to be accepted by the West. This is why a lot of times when Yeltsin got in trouble, he'd go to a summit or have some kind of meeting abroad, and the pictures of Yeltsin on television meeting with Clinton or with Kohl, these are always very important to secure the Russian domestic political support. The question is to what happens to Mr. Putin and what he believes, which is, again, a huge dark area for us, when he has to go meet with Mr. Clinton, when he has to make friends with Germany and with Britain.
Hmm. Joshua Rubenstein, thank you for joining us. Joshua Rubenstein from Amnesty International. Richard Lloyd, did you want to make a point?
Well, I would just, another factor is, as always, you know, the economy. And Russia right now is in fairly good shape, I think partially because oil prices are high. And another thing that, you know, that Putin, where we're talking about Putin as if he had maybe more power than in fact he does. I mean, to some degree, he's a hostage to the fortunes of the war in Chechnya. To some degree, he's a hostage to the floating prices of oil. If they go way down, Russia loses a lot of hard currency. And the other thing is, this is a separate but related point. The Russians have we saw this when Andropov came to power. The Russians don't necessarily look at somebody with an intelligence background. You know, it's KGB, of course, has more hideous associations to them than it does even to us. But they also know, or at least have a a fantasy that people from intelligence backgrounds at least have operating on real and solid information, and you know, intelligence has at least implies intelligence in the normal sense of the word. And so, to some degree, this is where the sort of the Giuliani image returns to my mind, that a lot of New Yorkers who are quite liberal in their politics were willing to put up with tactics on the street that were a little bit less than ideally liberal to get the streets of New York safe again, which they are. And so I can see Putin being accepted for any number of reasons by the liberal wing, as long as he doesn't totally crack down on the freedoms that Josh was referring to, which I don't think he can.
Could Putin beat Hillary Clinton for the Senate in New York?
No, nobody can beat Hillary.
We'll see. 1-800-423-8255, the Boris Yeltsin connection. Corey is on the line.
Hello.
Welcome, Corey.
I have a question, kind of a two-part question. Thinking of an interesting figure from Mr. Yeltsin's past, Alexander Lebed. First of all, the simple aspect of this is, what happened to Alexander Lebed? Because when he was around, it didn't seem that he was going away. The second, kind of more pointed question is, what happens when, whether by winning or by losing, Mr. Putin's popularity falls out as a result of Chechnya, and you have someone, be it Alexander Lebed or be it anyone else that kind of embodies his spirit, that can step in and say, this person has taken on the mantle of nationalism and militaristic nature, and he messed it up, but I've been doing it my entire career. Isn't it time we got serious about this? The concern, of course, being in my mind that Alexander Lebed did not strike me as a very, it struck me as somewhat of a frightening figure, in fact. And if he decides to come out of retirement and right around the Russian election time in a scenario like that, it seems that there could be a definite downturn in anything at all like democracy in Russian government.
Let me ask Steve Leisman and Richard Lurie, Corey, I mean, is Alexander Lebed still a player?
Well, it's probably important to remember where Lebed came from. How he was created as a national figure. In the 96 elections, Yeltsin's people essentially created Lebed as a way of drawing support from the communists. They then installed him in government after that, and Lebed showed that he couldn't be a team player by the rules that were in the Kremlin, insidious as those rules were. And he went off to become a governor of a region out there. I think it was Krasnoyarsk, maybe I'm wrong about that. And last I heard of Mr. Lebed, he got, or General Lebed, he got bogged down in running a region, actually doing governing rather than criticizing the existing government. I'm really interested in Richard's thought about this, but one thing that struck me in Moscow was, among the things that remained of Soviet propaganda was the incredible fear and distrust and perhaps hatred of fascism. And that's why I always thought General Lebed's possibilities politically were overstated, because it always struck me that the Russians were never going to be enamored of general.
I'm going to assume that your question, in a way, answers itself, because I have another one for Richard Lurie in the minute we have left.
Okay, sorry.
Here's a stumper, Richard. If we'd had Alexander Solzhenitsyn on the program today asking us from his sort of neo-orthodox, vaguely nationalist, anti-communist perspective to sum it up, what would he be saying about Russia today?
Well, Solzhenitsyn always takes the dark view, and I would think that he would say that Russia is sinking into kind of the slavery of materialism and putting politics in front of God and redemption or something like that. If you asked him about Putin, I'm sure he would find him, you know, a frightening and secular figure. But I want to say one thing about Yeltsin.
You're gonna say it to us.
Yeltsin's genius, and Lebed comes in. Yeltsin was always great at...
Go ahead, Richard. Richard, last word. Richard, we lost you, and I'm sorry to say we're out of time, too.
Okay.
Richard Lurie,
we'll be
Steve
back.
Leisman of the Wall Street Journal, thank you, and also to Andrew Higgins, the Moscow bureau chief of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. presented by the listeners of WBUR Boston and by PCs for Everyone, Windows 98, NT, and Linux-based computer systems and parts, building home PCs, corporate workstations, and servers, PCsForEveryone.com. And by Sunday River Ski Resort, featuring 8 interconnected mountains, 126 trails to explore, and an extensive snowmaking system, SundayRiver.com.
PRI, Public Radio International. From Boston.